Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. The state breaks ground on a new Delaware hospital for the chronically ill.
It's about building a space where our residents can feel at home, where their independence is respected, and where our staff can provide the exceptional care without any barriers or limitations.
We have more on the new facility and how it will improve care for those it serves. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also dive into a new study that explains why some areas of Delaware face higher odds of advanced breast cancer. Arts Playlist introduces us to the Delaware Theater Company's new managing director. And in Enlighten Me, we hear how community funding is helping the Nanticoke Indian Tribe keep its annual powwow running. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Last week, Delaware broke ground on a new Delaware Hospital for the Chronically Ill. The $90 million project will deliver a three-story facility with 120 beds to replace the current building built in 1961. Earlier this week, I was joined by David Newnham, Deputy Cabinet Secretary for the Delaware Department of Health and Social Services, to learn more about the new hospital and what it's expected to mean for its patients. When people hear about the Delaware Hospital for the Chronically Ill, I'm sure some people are not quite clear what that is. Could you give us a quick overview of the hospital's mission and who it serves?
Sure. So the Delaware Hospital for the Chronically Ill, which is fondly referred to as DHCI, has been a cornerstone of care in our state for nearly a century. In 1931, the Delaware legislature created the Old Age Welfare Commission, which soon purchased the land to build what was then called the State Welfare Home. It later became the State Home and Hospital for the Chronically Ill, and today we know it just as the Delaware Hospital for the Chronically Ill. The campus and original hospital in the Prickett Building dated back to the early 1930s, and today the Prickett Building is used for ancillary non-residential care services, as well as administrative space. Then in 1961, residents moved to what then was a brand new Candy Building on the campus. 64 years later, we are now preparing to move residents to a brand new facility designed to meet the needs of today and tomorrow. So the long-term care profile of those needing facility-level care looks a lot different than it did 20 or 30 years ago. So many more people are aging in their homes with in-home support services. So long-term care across the spectrum looks very different. And then DHCI itself is different even from that. So we serve those that cannot be served in community or home settings and also face challenges in private nursing homes. Some of those challenges could be justice involvement, histories of substance abuse and mental health, acquired and traumatic brain injury, really complex medical needs, and also those that are needing long-term care but are very young, that they have social challenges. It could be really challenging to meet some of their social needs.
How vital is it to have a facility like this to serve those various kind of populations that you mentioned?
So one of the things we always talk about in our admissions committee is if not here, where? And the answer to that is typically in an acute care hospital setting, which is certainly not the least restrictive setting we want these individuals to live their lives in.
You mentioned the current hospital building dates back to 1961. What are some of the issues a building of that age presents to delivering the best care possible to the patients who are there?
That's a great question. So the Delaware Hospital for the Chronically Ill is a five-star CMS rated facility. So it has received the highest level of nationally recognized rating from the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services. And that is with all the environmental challenges that exist within the structure. So some of those challenges are the licensed bed count is 175. That includes having three and four individuals in a fairly small room, which would in no way meet today's level of care. So we have to lower the census to be able to spread out across the facility and not have people on top of each other. Another issue is with it being a single story with fairly low ceilings, our maximum bariatric capacity is fairly low. So we aren't able to serve those above a certain weight. We also have a lot of other environmental issues just with the structure of where the nursing stations are located, lack of ability to kind of lock certain units down. We don't have any locked units at DHCI. So we have challenges admitting too many individuals that have wandering issues.
The new hospital is a $90 million project that's going to produce a three-story building with 120 beds. In what ways will it address those issues you just mentioned?
So we're integrating state-of-the-art adaptive equipment to support both the residents and the staff, including 8 bariatric rooms specific for those needs, advanced Hoyer lifts that enhance both resident and staff safety, new systems that replace portable oxygen tanks with built forced wall air. Everything our residents need will be accessible in one building. Right now, they have to leave the Kandy building to gain some of their to ex to access some of their therapies and other things. So physical and occupational therapies will be right there in the building. All the dining areas with a full service kitchen will be in the building. Believe it or not, our kitchen is in a separate building. So meals are prepared in a separate building and transported outside in the elements to get to the residents today. The canteen for non-mealtime food and beverage will be in the building. Multi-purpose auditorium, and we'll have additional Snoozlin' rooms. Currently, we only have one in the building. We'll have 2 additional ones.
You alluded to earlier kind of the change in the way care is handled these days, the standards for care. Can you talk a little bit specifically how those changes are going to be reflected in this new hospital, how it's going to look on a day-to-day basis for a patient there? What are some of the prominent things that will affect them on a day-to-day basis? Things like, I guess, you mentioned some technology. How about things like style of care and things like that?
Absolutely. So the care has always been 5-star. What occurs inside the building is absolutely the top tier of what one can expect in a long-term care setting. And that is due to the amazing dedicated staff and our families and our resident council driving that. So what they can expect is just it's a more pleasant environment. There'll be 3 courtyards. There are lake views. The lighting, a lot of natural light. The building is set up into neighborhoods instead of units, which will be very home-like. The residents will have a lot of say in what that look and feel is, and also what we name those sections as their home. So just a lot of not only improved technologies and adaptive equipment, but just a more pleasant environment.
I understand that parking has also been an issue, and that's one that's going to be addressed at this new facility.
Absolutely. So, in addition to the new Delaware Hospital for the Chronically Ill, there's been some addition on the campus, including the new public health lab and the new Denrag lab. So, parking has absolutely been a challenge and a sore spot. So, the staff and families are very excited for us to announce 190 additional parking spots.
And that seems like such a small thing, but for people who have to interact with it on a regular basis, that is no small thing.
It isn't, when you're coming to work, particularly in the elements, and you just want to get inside the building, and you've got to walk a long way or fight for parking, it's not fun at all.
So tell us a little bit about the timetable for completing this, and I guess what the transition will look like when that comes about.
Sure. So construction will take approximately 18 months. We look forward to cutting the ribbon on a beautiful new facility in early 2027. So over the next 16 to 18 months, we're going to welcome 100 construction workers onto the ca campus each day, supporting good jobs and fueling local business in the town of Smyrna. When it comes time to transition the residents, it's something we've done before. We'd used to have 3 long-term care facilities, and we have consolidated down to 1. So we've kind of become experts on mitigating transfer trauma and making the transfer from one facility to the next as smooth and seamless as possible. We're engaging the community, we're engaging the families, we're engaging the resident councils, we're engaging volunteers. We expect it to be a very smooth transition.
And I imagine during the construction, there's not a lot of issues for the patients. Really, the major thing for them is the move when it happens, right?
Absolutely.
How about the funding for this? Tell us a little bit about how the funding breaks down to make this possible.
Sure. So the project is roughly $90 million. We received $50 million in American Rescue Plan Act funds in 2021. Then we received $30 million from the Delaware Bond Bill Capital Improvement Committee in 2023, and then an additional $10 million in congressionally directed spending for the state-of-the-art equipment inside the new building, which was championed by U.S. Senator Chris Coons, along with Senator Tom Carper, and then U.S. Congresswoman, now Senator Lisa Blunt Rochester.
What'll happen to the old hospital and the other older building you mentioned on the campus? Is there currently a plan for what will happen to them and how they can be perhaps repurposed?
So there's lots of ideas. The Prickett Building is currently used for non-residential, non-clinical services as well as office space. And we envision the Candy Building used for something similar. It could be a mixed-use space. We probably will do an RFI to see what the interest or the need is in the community to see if that space could be of support.
Is there hopes that having that space to kind of noodle with will, give you some opportunities to try maybe some different things or new things that just weren't possible in the current setup?
Absolutely. I think in minimum, it will provide us an opportunity to lessen our need for leased space in the area. And at maximum, it'll meet some unmet needs in the community that we're able to blend into the campus.
I want to wrap up with the idea that, obviously, the primary focus is always the patients and their care. Ultimately, how significant a change will this new facility be for those who need it the most, the people who are there and engaging with care day to day?
I think that sometimes the incredible work that goes on at Delaware Hospital for the Chronically Ill, the incredible dedication from the staff, the care that actually goes on there is shadowed by the environmental challenges and by the institutional look and feel of the facility. When we say this will be a state-of-the-art facility, this will be a state-of-the-art facility. I think we're going to have to really think about our admissions process because I think people are probably going to be, knocking on our door wanting to come to the hospital for the chronically ill. So it's about building a space where our residents can feel at home, where their independence is respected, and where our staff can provide the exceptional care without any barriers or limitations. It's about meeting today's need and tomorrow's need for long-term care in a state-of-the-art facility. And our current governor, Matt Meyer, who, as made access to quality care for Delawareans a priority of his administration, it's a priority to meet those with the long-term care needs in a space that honors them and is person-centered.
Thanks to DHSS Deputy Secretary Dava Noonan for joining us on The Green this week. And stay with us. We delve into new research from Christiana Care that helps explain why certain areas of Delaware face higher odds of advanced breast cancer. That's next on The Green, here on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. A recent study by Christiana Care's Cawley Center for Translational Cancer Research at the Helen F. Graham Cancer Center and Research Institute shows some areas of Delaware have higher odds of advanced breast cancer. The research explains some of the reasons for those elevated rates and how that is shaping Christiana Care's response. This week, Delaware Public Media's Joey Irizarry sits down with Dr. Scott Siegel, the study's lead author and director of cancer control and population sciences at Christiana Care's Cawley Center, to discuss this research and what comes next.
Scott, you did research to pinpoint advanced breast cancer in Delaware, some of the hot spots. How did this research come about?
Sure. So we've been interested in addressing breast cancer at a state level for several years now because, unfortunately, we're at some of the top 10 lists that you don't want to be top 10 on. We have some of the higher rates of advanced breast cancer as a state, and this is particularly true for younger women. So some of our early research was really on trying to figure out where in a state do we see more of a burden of breast cancer? Do these cases happen to cluster? And so past studies showed us, yes, there are these hot spots that we've identified. This most recent study was really trying to understand, well, what's driving those hotspots? What are the factors that are contributing to them? So that, more importantly, what can be done about it to improve upon the situation?
And this research, it deals with advanced breast cancer. What is advanced breast cancer, and how does that maybe different from just breast cancer, or is there a difference?
All breast cancers, just like any cancer, receive a stage at diagnosis. And typically that's a stage 1, 2, 3, or 4, and there's subdivisions. So you might have stage 2A or 2B, for example. The higher the stage, typically the larger the cancer or the more aggressive it's likely to be. The stage of the cancer is very strongly correlated with outcomes. It's important to detect cancer at an early stage. That's why there's so much focus on screening and raising awareness and early detection campaigns. For this research, We defined advanced stage as stage 2A or up, and that's based off of a recommendation from research conducted by the National Cancer Institute.
As for the research, what did it show on advanced breast cancer and why certain areas of the state face higher odds? How does that work?
So in our prior study, we found two advanced breast cancer hotspots. One was in the northeast part of Wilmington, the city, and the other one was in Middletown. The one in Middletown was specifically among younger women, women under 50, whereas the hotspot in Wilmington was for all ages. What this study showed is that there's really two factors that seem to drive those hotspots. The first is rates of screening. Areas where you see lower rates of screening mammography, you are more likely to see advanced breast cancer. It just follows that if screening is meant to catch a cancer at an earlier stage and people are less likely to get screening, you have a greater odds of detecting it at a later stage. But what we also found is the tumor biology is important. Breast cancer is actually a bit of an oversimplification for what are multiple types of breast cancer. And so the more aggressive subtypes also seem to cluster. So where you have areas where you see a higher rate of those more aggressive breast cancer subtypes, such as triple negative breast cancer, and at the same time, areas with lower rates of screening, those are the areas where you're more likely to see an advanced breast cancer hotspot.
So now, like when people hear this, they might think, "Oh my God, I have to move. I have to get out of this area." And because, oh, and it could be because there's a power plant or something, that might. But this isn't one of those cases, though, right? You said when you said about Middletown, especially, it just maybe not as much screening early on, right?
So from a screening standpoint, we do know that where you live sometimes is correlated with your likelihood of getting screening. We know that there's differences in socioeconomic status, access to healthcare. So certain communities have less healthcare access. And so those are the same communities you see lower rates of screening. All else held equal, places that have lower screening rates, you're going to see more advanced breast cancer. So moving doesn't necessarily solve anything unless, you're actually increasing your access to screening. On the other hand, the type of subtype of breast cancer can be related to what we call exposures. Those could be the things, behavioral exposures, environmental exposures. It could be what you eat, how much exercise you get, but it can also be other environmental factors that are increasingly getting researched, such as air quality, water quality. We don't have any specific evidence in the study that says it's those environmental exposures that are increasing the risk, but we do know things like metabolic health, obesity, type 2 diabetes, whether you drink a lot of alcohol, if you had a baby and breastfed or didn't, those are all things that may contribute to your risk of more aggressive tumor biology. So the best thing an individual can do is certainly get your screening, but pay attention to what risk factors there are and the things that you can modify, try to improve upon.
How does knowing that there are certain areas that can be hotspots for advanced breast cancer help with your response in treatment and prevention? Essentially, how do you take the data and then turn it into medical care?
That's a great question and really our primary focus. So what we're doing in one of those hotspots right now is we have a community health worker embedded in the community. So this is someone who is there to provide education, help people overcome whatever barriers they have to healthcare, answer questions if they have an insurance issue, if they have a transportation or a childcare issue, whatever's getting in the way of them getting screened. This community health worker is really in there working to overcome those barriers so that women get their mammography. We're also there to share information about risk factors and connect them to other resources. So if you have a hard time accessing a secure supply of food or housing, these are things that the community health worker can connect you to other resources and help you address those needs, which may actually also reduce those risk factors we were just talking about.
Moving forward here, what's the next step? How do you turn these, especially here in Delaware, these two particular hot spots, and you turn them around and where they're not hot spots in the future?
Right. So the first effort is in that Wilmington hotspot. Our goal, simply stated, is to turn it from hot to cold. We don't want it to be a hotspot. We think by increasing screening, by addressing those risk factors, we can reduce the rates of advanced breast cancer. Assuming we're successful, then the goal is to scale that to other hotspots. Middletown would be certainly on the list. In addition, everything we focused on so far has been in New Castle County, but we're currently working with the state and the state cancer registry to analyze data for Kent and Sussex as well. And we expect to have results out this fall that talk about the priority communities in those counties that we would also want to focus on. And this is going to be a collaborative effort across health systems, across community organizations, working with the state government, with policymakers to really reach everybody. And I just want to call to memory, not everybody necessarily is aware of this, but about a decade ago, the state of Delaware, acting through the Delaware Cancer Consortium, was able to make tremendous inroads on reducing the burden of colorectal cancer with a similar approach. What we're trying to do is repeat that success, but now for breast cancer.
And you can also use maybe some of these practices, and even without researching those areas, just to use them in some spots so they don't become hotspots in the future, right? I mean, is that also part of this, or is it a research-based topic where you want to do the research first and then go attack the area?
It's intervention research. So the way we look at it is we don't want to just study this for the sake of studying it, but we also don't want to act aimlessly because what we want to do is we know that there are a finite set of resources we can allocate to this. We really want to maximize our bang for the buck. So that's why the overall approach we're using is what's called a precision health approach. And by precision, it means we're going to put the resources where we think we can make the biggest impact. So yes, we need to study it a little bit to know where to act. We can't put a community health worker in every neighborhood, for example, but if we put them in a half a dozen or 10 neighborhoods and they make a huge impact and it has an outsized result for the state, then that was worth probably the 6 months or the year it took to understand where to focus.
How can we take what we've learned here in Delaware through this research nationally and help around the country?
That's another reason why we like to do the research, is because when we publish, we're disseminating what we're learning. All the methods we're using to identify these communities, which are pretty novel approaches for this work, now others can see, they can use their own state data, they can do similar analyses, whether it's Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Maryland. They all have cancer registries for their state, and they can look, where do we have problems? Now, it may not be breast cancer. They may have a different cancer, but you can use the same methods. And then you can think about, well, what's modifiable? How do we improve early detection? What are the risk factors? What are the best ways to reach those high priority communities? So it's certainly our hope, like we did with colorectal, for Delaware to lead the country on how to address breast cancer.
And no matter the cancer, no matter the area, always just be on top of your safety, or your health, right? And take those precautions before it happens, right?
Right. An ounce of prevention goes a long way in cancer, like it does in other health conditions. So absolutely.
Thanks to Dr. Scott Siegel, Director of Cancer Control and Population Sciences at ChristianaCare's Cawley Center, and our Joey Irizarry for joining us on The Green this week. Up next, Arts Playlist, where we meet the new Managing Director at the Delaware Theater Company. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. For more than four decades, the Delaware Theater Company has been entertaining audiences in and around Wilmington. Recently, the organization underwent a reinvention of sorts, announcing that it was moving to a leadership model with two people at the top, an artistic director and a managing director. Earlier this year, the company announced Broadway veteran Mimi Warnick as its producing artistic director. And this month, they tapped Candace Buchanan to be managing director. On this edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny chats with Buchanan and Warnick about their vision and the Delaware Theater Company's future.
Candace, tell me a little bit about yourself and your background.
Yeah, I am not a native Delawarean. I am from West Virginia and came to Delaware for college a little over 20 years ago, and have been here since. So I have now been in Delaware longer than anywhere else. But my background is in nonprofit leadership and education. I've spent some time working with the Delaware Department of Education, the Governor's Office, and several nonprofits that are focused in education and youth development.
So Delaware Theater Company has both a managing director, you, and a producing artistic director, Mimi Warnick. Talk about what those two roles do and how they collaborate and overlap.
Mimi and I think can both jump in on this one. But, you know, Mimi has spent the last year really focusing on the artistic vision, all of the production aspects, working with the cast, the show, coming up with the season. And this managing director position really focuses on the implementation of that vision and supporting all of the staff and their goals, making sure that we have all the resources so that we can produce some incredible live theater.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think all the expertise Candace brings in nonprofit leadership is something that the theater is in a really great place when it comes to producing shows and programming shows, thanks to our leadership, like over the past 15 years. But now it's in a place where we can thrive a little bit more. So to make sure that, you know, we have a soft place to land after every production and that we can continue to grow and not just maintain. I think what's also really exciting is that, you know, DTC is in a really good place within the area and obviously the Philadelphia greater region, and even like within the New York and larger area with the shows that we like to produce. But with Candace's local connections and toolboxes and resources, it's going to be really exciting to kind of bring a lot of our programming and engagement right back here into Wilmington.
I wonder for both of you, what do you see as the biggest priority that faces the company right now? Both of you being kind of new in your tenure with the company.
Yep. You know, I think, you know, while I'm more on the implementation management side, I do have some vision around kind of where we want to be. And that's really to deepen the theater's connection to the community. We want to make sure that everyone in Wilmington feels welcome. This is a space where everyone can see themselves, where, you know, they're reflected on stage. They can come into a safe space that kind of feels like home, you know, just watching TV in your living room, but it's live theater. The facility is beautifully renovated and, you know, we want folks to experience that. We have a lot of opportunities to expand our access and our partnerships and really just invite more people into the theater so that they can experience, you know, in some cases, what can be a life-changing, transformative experience.
Yeah, I agree with all that. I think it's all about just expanding what we already have and making sure that we can, you know, excite and maintain our awesome subscribers and theater goers, but ultimately create new ones for generations to come and be way more than just a theater, but a cultural center for the city. And really just make people know that we're, you know, along the riverfront doing really cool things.
And let me follow up on that just a little bit, too, because it seems to me with any of the arts, whether it's visual art, dance, theater, music, the biggest hurdle to creating a new audience member is just that first visit. It's the intimidation of going into a situation you may not be familiar with to view the performing arts. How do you address that first hurdle of getting people in the door?
Ultimately, I think it's just making it a lot more familiar and casual. I think people love to do what they're familiar with in their free time and in their recreational time. And it's a way to relax and kind of escape and disconnect. So I think when you're going to the theater for the first time, it can be intimidating because it's something new and it's something, you know, that like you might not be used to. So why would you do that in your free time? That's just as intimidating as work or school. So I think it's, you know, finding different pathways than just buying the ticket and seeing the show. And what are other ways that, you know, DTC can become way more familiar in other capacities. So is that hosting different events, integrating in the community in different ways, getting outside our doors. So just becoming way more of a familiar name and face so that, you know, by the time you see the exciting show, it's like, you know who we are and you know what we do and you know what to expect from us.
Yeah, and I would add, I think, we can also leverage the educational aspects of what we do. You know, we work with youth in the community, elementary schools, middle schools, high schools, and, you know, getting them in through the schools that they're attending. So, you know, eliminating some of those barriers, you know, they're already going to school, building this into connections with the curriculum. And so, you know, they go home and they share those experiences with their family, and then they want to come back to the next show. And so, you know, creating that passion early on to continue, you know, opening doors for the community.
And I want to also follow up on something that you said, Candace, about creating a safe space, a welcoming space. And I wonder if you could talk just a little bit more about that and what that looks like and feels like.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the most exciting things for me. You know, I have a lot of experience in the nonprofit space, but I have personal passion for theater and the arts. You know, growing up in a small town in West Virginia, you know, I didn't make it to New York City every weekend or anything like that. But community theater was a big part of my life. You know, my dad directed church plays and all kinds of things. And, you know, those are some of the times that I remember with, you know, my friends, my family, the community. And now even with my daughter, she is in theater. And some of the things that I hear from kids all of the time is, you know, that's a safe space. It's a welcoming space where you can be yourself, where you can open up. And so not just from experiencing it, from seeing what's happening on stage, but some of those opportunities, again, like the education, the summer camps where we get them involved and we give folks the opportunity to really come into themselves and in a safe space, in a safe way where we know in schools may not always be the best place for that, but just providing the right resources and the people to encourage people to be themselves. And, you know, you can be dramatic. You can, you know, those things are okay. But just helping folks to kind of hone in on who they are. And, you know, I truly believe that theater is a place where that's true for a lot of people.
I know this is a really exciting time for Delaware Theatre Company. You've got in the upcoming season, two world premieres and a U.S. premiere. Can you kind of talk me through the upcoming season a little bit?
Yeah, no, it's really exciting. This past Tuesday, 2 days ago, we started first rehearsals for our play Spinner. It's a new play by Ray Dittinger, who wrote Tommy and Me. So that's been around in the area, produced many times. So it's his new take, not football this time, but hockey. And it's really, really awesome. And not only is it exploring a story that Ray always wanted to tell throughout his career, but I think we're leveling it up in a way of using tech and different elements that, you know, audiences and his familiar audiences may not be expecting. So that's really exciting to kick us all off. He's also pairing almost every performance with an awesome talkback speaker, whether that be, you know, a local sports legend, media star, a good friend of his that he's worked with throughout his career, to kind of pair the experience and talk more about, you know, why he wanted to write it and why he wanted to share it. And then we're welcoming back Leon Gray, who has been at DTC before with Black Angels Over Tuskegee and Kings of Harlem, with his new play, Girls of Summer, which is featuring an all-female African-American cast, which we're very excited about, and really champion this female narrative and story of the All-American Girls Black baseball team, kind of the summer after what people think about with the All-American Girls White baseball team. Really cool drama, locker room drama, a lot of good conversation, a lot of good dialogue. And then in December, we're presenting Wolfpack Performing Arts. It's a production of Shrek, so it's a really cool partnership and presenting moment for, you know, education and theater education around the holidays, and really just, you know, having fun with something like Shrek. It's one of my favorites, so really excited. And then the spring is definitely dedicated to new work. In the winter, we're welcoming Glory Ride, a new musical that premiered in London, but we're welcoming over here and has its sights set on, you know, Broadway and the commercial market. So that'll be a New York production that kind of comes down to us and we produce. So it's going to be amazing, a World War II story. And then we're closing the season with a little bit more of a homegrown produced new work, The Checkerboard Watch, which is about sailors in the 1850s and kind of all their cultural emerging, combining, transforming all through the power of song, music, and sea shanties. So we definitely have range this year, definitely something for everyone. But ultimately, my hope is, you know, getting all different types of audiences. I think each show really caters to a specific group that might not have been in the theater for a while. So I hope if you join us for Spinner that, you know, you'll take something from every show and you'll be with us till the end of Checkerboard, and then ultimately be really excited for next year.
Thanks to Delaware Theater Company's new managing director, Candace Buchanan, its producing artistic director, Mimi Warnick, and our Martin Matheny for joining us on Arts Playlist. You can find out more about the Delaware Theater Company's upcoming productions at DelawareTheater.org. And we wrap up The Green next with Enlighten Me, where we learn how the Nanticoke Indian tribe is overcoming financial hurdles to keep their annual powwow going. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. One of the major events on the Nanticoke Indian Tribe's calendar is its annual powwow. The 47th edition of the powwow will be held September 6th and 7th in Milton. But to bring the event to life again this year, the tribe needed some financial help, turning to the community to deliver $30,000 in needed funding, nearly half coming from a GoFundMe effort. In this edition of Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Abigail Lee sits down with Nanticoke Indian Tribe Chief Avery Johnson to talk about the 47th annual powwow, the cultural significance of powwows, and how this community fundraising brought this year's event to the finish line.
Can you tell me a little bit about the powwow? I know it's happening September 6th, starting at 10 a.m. Can you just tell us a little bit about what that looks like?
It's a two-day event. It's the 6th and the 7th. It's the 47th annual powwow. We've had a couple rainouts and COVID that we'd probably be at our 49th powwow if we hadn't had the COVID shutdown and the rainout back in 2018. It's a cultural event. I guess the best way to explain it to someone that may be from Delaware would be something like a Greek festival or a Polish festival where they celebrate their heritage. Well, we celebrate our heritage and we educate the public on our history, our culture. There's opportunities to have native food, to listen to the native drum, native flute players, see native dance, hear native storytelling. It's a very vibrant, colorful, and entertaining and educational event.
Absolutely. Thank you for that. So I also wanted to ask a little, I know, like you've said, this is the 47th powwow with a couple exceptions in there for COVID. Can you talk a little bit about how this came to be in Delaware and how this came to be a tradition?
We're located in Delaware. We're located in Sussex County along the Indian River, Oak Orchard specifically, right there along the Indian River. That's basically where we've resided, and we've resided there for a couple hundred years. Actually, we had revived our powwows back in the 1920s. But then when the war started and things kind of went awry, they stopped. But then about 50 years ago, 49 years ago, we started them back up. But that's our huge population. That's where we're located. That's where we have our community center, our museum, our church. It's all located in Millsboro, Oak Orchard type area.
Can you talk a little bit about, you know, what kind of cultural celebrations will happen and, you know, why this is important to the community?
Well, it's always important to all people of all different ethnicities to celebrate their culture, celebrate their history, teach their youth coming up about, you know, those ancestors before them, the things that they went through and how they struggled and what they've done to survive and their resiliency. We like our youth to not only celebrate our history, but talk to our elders so they can understand and appreciate where they are today and keep this culture moving forward. You know, we all have diverse backgrounds. We travel throughout the world, but there's no place like home. And you hear that all the time. So there's no place like for us, our powwow and our area there in Millsboro and Oak Orchard, where we feel the most comfortable, the safest. And a lot of times people don't understand their history, right? We become educated, we move away, and we don't understand our history. So we like to keep that alive.
Absolutely. And so I'm looking at the poster right now. And one of the things listed is that there are dances. Can you talk a little bit about what that will look like?
We have traditional dances. There's the jingle dress dance. There's the grass dance, the ribbon skirt dance, ribbon dances that show and have different meanings to those individuals there. And it's explained by the MC, each dance, what it represents, why it is the way it is. And we have multiple performers from other tribes. We typically have
individuals representing anywhere from 35 to 40 tribes. We actually have a female hoop dancer that has traveled the world, and she's actually performed at the president inauguration and several other events. So it's a very exciting event. Then we actually have a dance where we invite the public to come in and dance with us. And we also honor the veterans and first responders. And we ask them to enter the circle, the sacred circle, and dance with our dancers. So it's a very inclusive event.
So you say that a lot of the attendees and folks who are dancing or taking part are from other tribes. Can you talk about why you decide to widen the net of folks who can perform and participate as opposed to just including people in the Nanticoke Indian tribe?
That's how our native community is. We're all one big community. And we go to their events and they come to our events. And that's just respect. We respect them. They respect us. They bring some of their leadership. Our leadership goes to their events. And we reciprocate. It's just our customs. That's how it's been for hundreds of years. And it'll continue to be that way.
That makes sense to me. I was also curious if there will be food at the event.
We have our own food court where we sit. We serve our native foods. And then we do have another couple of native food vendors. And then for those individuals that would prefer not to, to indulge in our native foods, then we just have other vendors serving typical vendor food.
Now, I myself am not a picky eater, so I'm curious what kinds of food will be offered that's not, you know, the traditional, I guess, festival food.
Okay, so we have what we call our fry bread, which is a dough that is deep fried, and then it's served with butter, lots of butter, and powdered sugar and cinnamon sugar. We also have Indian tacos, which is served on that same bread with a specialty taco type ground beef mix that our tribe puts together. And we serve that. We also have what we call a powwow pot roast that is put together on this fry bread. And we also have succotash, which I'm sure you know what succotash is, that is done specifically done with a tribal recipe. Those would be the main foods that we serve. And they seem to be very well-liked, and the lines are extremely long.
All right. So we'll come with, you know, sunscreen and hats to prep for those lines. I wanted to pivot a little bit to talk about the funding. And I know that there was a pivot toward community funding through a GoFundMe. Can you talk a little bit about what that looked like this year? Because from what I understand, there was a little bit of a shift.
It was a necessity. You know, we've been doing this for 47 years and we've never had to do anything like this. But I'm not an economist, so I can't explain to you why the economy is the way it is. But I know costs have went up across the board with everything. It's an average of $80,000. It was a $30,000 shortfall. And very easy to explain. We had some very large sponsors who, unfortunately, due to some things that have happened recently with the government, that they were unable to actually sponsor us at all. And some of our other sponsors dropped quite considerably, going from 5,000 to 1,000. So our GoFundMe was set at 30,000. By the time we reached 15,000, we had anonymous sponsors who contacted us and made up that difference.
What does it tell you that, you know, you were able to raise this money fairly quickly?
Well, it tells us that people are very supportive once they know that you're in this dire need and you're not some organization that has been asking for handouts. You've worked very hard and very diligently for many, many years. And this was actually a shock to everyone. You just can't bury your head in the sand. You come up with a solution and you continue to move forward. And, you know, we'll just work much harder again this year. If we can work any harder than what we already worked, since we're all volunteers, we have 4 part-time employees and a full-time museum curator. And everyone else is a volunteer like myself. We're very proud of everything that we do, and we're very proud of our powwow. And we welcome people to come and join us and see just what it's all about.
And I want to ask hypothetically, had those funds not been raised, what would have happened? What would the power have looked like without that, you know, say 30,000?
That's a great question. And I'm hoping that I never have to answer that question. And I don't look forward to answering that question, but I'm sure there would have had to been many, many cutbacks, maybe no food, you know, maybe no food to sell because the food isn't cheap and we have to buy the food to do that. We obviously couldn't less police support because we can't have the event without the police. Less performers. We would have had to cut back on performers. It just wouldn't be the same event. And at some point in time, we'd probably have to move the event. That's something that we don't want to think about, right?
I mean, I can imagine such a relief.
You know what's more than just a relief? It's that to find out that people actually care. Sometimes there's an old saying that sometimes things happen for a reason. Maybe it enlightened a lot of people, and it showed us that people really, really, really care. We really feel proud that there are so many people out there that really cared about us.
Definitely sounds like a production. I am certainly looking forward to attending. Is there anything I didn't ask that I should have, or something else you'd like to add?
I'll tell you a story. I remember standing there, one of our powwows, and the line for the taco was, I don't know, 100 or so people standing in line, maybe 150. It was a very long line. And I apologized to a group that was standing in line that I'm sorry, you know, we just can't move fast enough. You know, there's just so many people here. And they said, you know what? Don't apologize. We love this place. This is the place to be and feel proud of what you're doing. And from that moment on, it's resonated with me and it always will resonate with me that, you know, people really care and people enjoy our event. So come out and enjoy the event.
I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes with me today.
Thanks to Nanticoke Indian Tribe Chief Avery Johnson for enlightening us this week. The 47th annual Nanticoke Indian Tribe Powwow is September 6th and 7th in Milton. More information on it can be found at the tribe's website, nanticokeindians.org. And we've hit the finish line for this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are available online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking Newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, Delaware Public Media's Joey Irizarry, Abigail Lee, and Martin Matheny. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Bernsing. Thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.